Please be seated. Mr. Walsh.
Suggestion. I thought it might make some sense, given the longer indication for cross-examination, if Ms. Irvine went first on this instance. I'm sorry to play around with your schedule,
because
we've been doing well today. I just thought it might mean that the number of questions that I put are reduced even further.
Okay. All right. So, Ms. Irvine, the floor is yours.
Your Honour. Dr. Hayes, I'd just like to start by going back to some of the questions that my friend Mr. Moore asked you. In particular, the manner in which you described the calculation of MALF. And I understood your answer to be that you would take the recorded flow data, look for the 7 days of low flow, and then average them across the years of data available.
That's correct.
So in Otago, that is going to be a calculation of the observed 7-day MALF, isn't it?
That's correct.
It isn't going to be a calculation of the naturalised 7-day MALF.
No, that wouldn't be.
Can I take you, please, to paragraphs 24 to 27 of your evidence in chief? At those paragraphs, you talk about the interaction of minimum flows and allocation limits?
Yes.
Now, those mechanisms are not the only levers we have to pull in relation to managing flows and waterways, are they?
Could you give me an example of what you're thinking of?
Well, we could. Well, flows will be influenced by the pattern of use within the catchment we're looking at, such as the types of water use, where the water might be extracted from within the catchment. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, all that's affecting the flow.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Whether there are water sharing or rationing regimes in place would affect things like flow variability as well. You'd agree?
Yes, that's correct.
And you would also agree that volume constraints on abstraction would have an influence on flow variability as well?
Yes.
Can I take you, please, to paragraph 31 of your evidence? And in this paragraph, you comment that ecological responses are not binary.
That's correct.
And so no single value would result in minor adverse effects or not, would it? There could be a range of values.
It's fuzzy, yes. No.
And if we go to paragraph 37 of your evidence, you say that the level of flow retention or habitat retention will be responsive to the values that you're seeking to protect or manage. Is that a fair summary?
Can you state that again, please?
That the level of flow, retention, and so on will be responsive to the values that you're seeking to protect or manage.
Just pause there a second. I just need to reread the paragraph. Right, if that's not a correct summary, you should just say so.
It's a paraphrasing of what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yep.
So just to clarify, depending on the importance of an in-stream value, that will affect the degree of protection that you would apply.
Yes.
It may affect your minimum flow limit. It may also affect your allocation limit.
Yeah. So it's somewhat of a contradiction, isn't it, that you are promoting a one-size-fits-all threshold in relation to what effects may be minor or not.
Except you've got to come up with some value, that's all. That's the reason.
We'll talk about that more.
Okay.
I'd like to move on to, I suppose, your discussion of the proposed thresholds. And I think you agreed with my friend that, Mr. Moore, that you have relied quite heavily on the proposed NES in guiding your analysis and your evidence. There are other documents which we'll come to, but the NES was one of them.
That's correct.
And I'd like to, I suppose, discuss that in more detail. You have in front of you still a copy of the proposed National Environmental Standard, the discussion document.
Yep.
Now, if I could take you, please, to section 1.2, which is on page 2 of the document.
Okay, I'm there.
And at the bottom of that page, it talks about the preferred options for addressing the problems that have been identified. And there's two bullet points at the bottom of the page. You see those?
Yes, I do.
And the preferred option is a combination of setting interim limits on alterations and flows, and secondly, providing a process for selecting the appropriate technical methods for evaluating the ecological flow component of environmental
correct.
Flows.
Mm.
Now, do you understand that in Otago there have been some environmental limits set in the plan?
Yes.
And so you would agree that in Otago, any interim limits that would have been set under this NES would only apply insofar as Otago didn't have its own?
Just pause there a second. So can you just, I want to take a note of the question before I have the answer. So in Otago, any interim limits?
Any interim limits wouldn't apply insofar as Otago had set its own.
And where do you get that from here?
I'll come to that, Your Honour.
Probably is a planning question. Is this something that you know from this document? I mean, you're a co-author, so you may or may not know.
My understanding from the document is that the limits, the proposed limits in here, would apply to those rivers in which limits have not already been set by a regional plan.
Yes, that's my understanding too.
Mm. And I'll just take a note of that.
If we turn to page 3 of the document, the first paragraph and the final sentence, the authors make it clear, don't they, that the determination of appropriate limits remains a regional council decision. keeping in mind any national policy direction given through a national policy statement.
Yes, that's correct.
I'd like to go, please, to section 2.3 of the document, which is at page 9.
Just pause there a second, let the court catch up.
Certainly.
Your question?
If you refer to the fifth paragraph, it's also recorded that environmental flows and water levels have been set through resource consent processes, doesn't it?
Yes.
If we turn over to page 10, please. Section 2.4. which talks about the implementation of environmental flows. Paragraph 4 notes that the complexity of environmental flows and water levels should match the existing knowledge and physical characteristics of the resource. And in particular, the final sentence comments that where there is the possibility of storage or capacity to take water at high flows, that we need to apply a more complex regime to the setting of environmental flows and water levels, doesn't it?
That's correct.
Relevance.
Are we carrying on with this line of questioning?
I know, I want to know the relevance of this line of questioning.
Yes, and what will become apparent as I continue is that the mechanism that was set out in this document is in part about the method for assessing how we set environmental flows and limits, that the standards that Mr. Hayes has relied on were not intended to be used as de facto limits. They were intended to be used as a signal to determine how complex your analysis needs to be when setting your environmental flows and limits.
I'm not sure that I understand that, but then how could I understand it unless I read the entire document? Then what weight would I place on this document anyway? It's only a discussion paper.
The document is, but it is the source of the standards that, or at least in part the source of the standards that Mr. Hayes draws through into his evidence.
So, that's understood, but you need to get to your point more quickly and in a director route, and still don't know where you're going.
Okay.
So where are you going with this? Apart from undermining, you know, the thresholds, which is completely a legitimate line of cross-examination, I mean, Mr. Moore has already challenged that, but on different grounds.
Mm.
Where are you going? That is to say that, yeah, I really did not understand your relevance statement. So what is the relevance?
Perhaps I'll cut to the chase a little quicker through my questions, and then I hope that it will become apparent.
Yes. Off you go.
Carry on. So if we go to paragraph 110 of your evidence, Dr. Hayes. You say that tables 1 and 2, which I take to be tables 1 and 2 in your evidence, provide helpful guidance for setting flows.
Yes.
Now, am I correct that those tables 1 and 2 are tables from the draft guidelines for selection of methods to determine ecological flows?
Yes, they are.
And that was the report that you assisted in the preparation of, that's referred to in the proposed NES document?
That's correct, and I also took account of the other aspect of the NES, and that was the limits that they proposed,
yes,
for interim solutions to,
yes,
situations where there wasn't enough information yet,
yes,
to apply methods.
Yes.
And so it was a stopgap measure until they do that.
Yes. So if we can go, please, to Appendix 4 of the proposed environmental standard. And in particular, page 54, where it sets out the recommendations for rivers.
Yes.
And the recommendation was that it is proposed that the approach to selecting technical methods to determine the ecosystem and flow requirements of rivers is based initially on risk, on the deleterious effects on in-stream habitat according to species present and natural mean stream flow. And there we see table A41, which is reproduced in your evidence, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
And so is my understanding correct that this table essentially identifies the proportion of mean flow and an analysis of the risk that an alteration in mean flow would present to the various categories of fish species in the table?
Yeah, that's correct.
And if we turn over the page to page 55 of the document, it's table A42, which you have also reproduced in your evidence.
That's correct.
And again, this discusses or identifies the relationship between hydrological alteration and risk for a range of, or for species.
Yes, that's correct.
The first paragraph on page 55 says that once you have once you've determined the degree of hydrological alteration, then you turn to table 3, which lists the technical methods that should be used to assess ecological flow requirements.
That's correct.
So where we have a high degree of hydrological alteration and a high degree of significance in terms of in-stream values, this report indicates that we should be undertaking a comprehensive analysis of the proposed environmental flows.
Yeah, correct.
All I'd like to contextualise what is a high degree of hydrological alteration. Would you agree that where we are considering a catchment that contains dams and storage, that will often result in a high degree of hydrological alteration?
Yes.
In catchments where there has historically been water abstraction and conveyance methods, that would also be a high level of hydrological alteration?
Yes.
Do you have Mr. Hickey's evidence available to you?
Sorry, I don't hear. Got it electronically. But
sure.
Are you going to run through all of the situations which have a high degree of hydrological alteration, or is your proposal just those two?
Well, perhaps I'll put that to the witness, Your Honour.
Well, and he may or may not be the correct witness because he's not a hydrologist, but you can ask him.
Yeah. Are there other things other than dams or abstraction and conveyance systems that would affect hydrological alteration?
I can't think of any at the moment, but it's usually dams, major diversions. Yeah.
So the answer is, if you're damming, if you're diverting, that impacts the hydrological flow to a high degree?
So it alters the flow, can alter the flow to a large degree, yes.
What
so
about
it's high.
If you're taking groundwater resources from a connected, which is from an aquifer connected to a surface water body?
Sure, if they were
if
they were large abstractions. Yes,
and what if you're actually just taking straight from the water body? That could do it too, from the surface water body.
Yeah, you have to have very large pumps to do that, but yes.
Are there any other circumstances that you're aware of, or would you defer to a hydrologist on that?
I'd defer to a hydrologist. I can't think of any others.
Okay. We're wanting to look at Mr. Hickey's
yes,
evidence.
If we can
Dr. Hickey, sorry.
Get Matthew Hickey's evidence in chief, please, Madam Registrar.
And just give me a chance to catch up because I've gone off the line.
If you could turn to page 13, please.
And just one moment. Page 13, what paragraph?
It is paragraph 37 in the table 2, which follows it.
Okay, just let the court read. I'm not sure where you're going to go with this. And this witness is already looking at the context for paragraph 37 in the table that follows, I would have, which is the immediately preceding paragraph 36, I would have thought this witness has already put doubt from his perspective as to the statement which is contained at paragraph 36 in terms of the knowledge of surface water flows.
Yes, well,
so to be fair, you would need to ask him questions about that before you move on to 37, otherwise you're just simply going to be asking him to accept the underlying proposition is that you have good knowledge about surface water flows or connected groundwater flows. This witness has said that is not his understanding, but this witness is not a hydrologist.
What I'm wanting to discuss with Dr. Hayes, Your Honour, is that the data that is available within the catchments identified by Mr. Hickey at his table 2 would enable most, if not all, of the methods to be applied in relation to highly altered catchments with high values.
Which methods?
In table A43 of the draft NES, which we've just been looking at.
So is your question assuming that Dr. Hickey, is it Dr. Hickey or Mr.?
Mr.
Assuming Mr. Hickey is correct and those records are available, and assuming the records contain relevant data and facts which are pertinent to the matters listed in table 4.3, then you could apply the methods in table 4.3 from the NES. Is that your question?
Yes, and that is in fact what has been done.
Well, I don't know whether that's been done or not. How would I know that?
Well, I think it'll come out of the evidence that ORUG is presenting, Your Honour.
You mean in terms of it's got an application for resource consent?
Correct.
Well, look, I've read your evidence and I haven't got those applications before me, do I?
Not currently, no.
No, not currently. So anyway, for three catchments, and there are only three catchments, I don't know whether they are the FMU catchments or something smaller than the FMU catchments, but for Manuhita Kia, Cardrona and Arrow. What's your question?
My point, Your Honour, is that the draft NES standards, it was not as simple as simply putting in place interim limits.
In the manner which has been proposed.
Correct.
Well, I think Mr. Moore secured that through his own line of cross-examination.
Right, well, we'll move on, shall we?
Well, it's over to you, but I'm just not sure where this is going. I can't test the veracity, the merits-based veracity of any application for resource consent, which is not before a court, can
I? No, I understand that, and I'm not asking you to do that.
Okay, all right.
Shall I move on?
It's over to you. As I said, I'm not sure. I am not sure how this line of cross-examination addresses the plan change, which is the only thing in front of us. I am sure how Mr. Moore's line of cross-examination, I am sure I have an idea where that where that goes. But I am not sure yours goes,
okay.
Except that you may be then using it as a foundation to say applications for resource consent have been filed on the basis of table 4.3 of the draft NES. Is that correct? That's what you're going to be submitting. Therefore, we should just let those applications be decided.
No, that's probably not what I'm going to be submitting.
Where are you going with this?
The point is that the interim standards were not intended to apply to highly altered catchments.
For her, what, sorry?
For highly altered catchments.
Highly altered catchments.
There was a lot of complexity.
Oh, why didn't you put that? That's a good question. So the simple thresholds, I'm not sure that they are simple, but anyway, the thresholds recommended by this witness are not meant to apply to highly altered catchments. And I suppose you first got to establish with this witness that Manahere Kia, since you're interested in this, Manahere Kia, Kadra and Onara are highly altered catchments. Why are they highly altered catchments? Is it not the case that the thresholds are not to apply there, but the NES was recommending a different assessment methodology?
Yes.
And he might agree with all of that, and then... And then Mr. Moore comes in and says, oh, well, that's only part of the equation. You should have been also looking at natural character and cultural values and, you know, and all of those other values.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we agree on that, that the standards were really relating to one aspect.
One aspect of...
environmental many. Flows, yes.
Yeah. So we can... So if you want to pursue the proposition that the thresholds not applying should not be applied in isolation, perhaps to highly altered catchments, then I think you can certainly do that, and that would be helpful. But then to set it in, we're doing this on the resource consents, which are not before us, I think that's the step too far, because the court's not going to be drawn into your resource consent. It's not asked to make a decision about it. It's not even before us.
No, and
it's actually not inviting you to also table the matter. It's not.
Well, we've got the message. You've got enough paperwork as it is.
Pardon?
We've got the message. You've got enough paperwork as
it is. Yeah. Thousands and thousands of pages.
Yes.
But anyway, I do think that point is valid. A simple application of the thresholds when more is needed. Or recommended in the draft, I think it's a perfectly valid point to make.
Mm. Yes.
Or point to pursue. You can make it after you've pursued it.
So perhaps we'll discuss that point in the context of the Manahere Kia, because I think you are familiar with that catchment, aren't you?
Yeah. Somewhat familiar, but...
Yes.
Yeah.
So the Manahere Kia... possesses some of the features that we've talked about in terms of hydrological alteration. We have Falls Dam, for example. Correct?
Yes. Highly complicated, complex hydrology.
Yes. Mm. And in that context, you would agree that the proposed standards would have anticipated that the full suite of assessments identified in Table 4.3, which is the bottom right-hand box, would be undertaken to assess the environmental flows and water levels in that catchment?
Probably not the full suite, because some of them are awfully expensive. So you have to have some balance between the budget that you have and trying to improve the precision and accuracy of effects assessment.
Hmm. It's my understanding that in relation to the Manahere Kia catchment, that Fish and Game have attempted to assist with some of this, and I think you've done bioenergetics modelling, haven't you?
I haven't done bioenergetics modelling. I know there are some existing habitat modelling exercises that have been done, flow-related habitat or hydraulic habitat modelling. And I've been involved in an additional piece of work,
mm-hmm.
which is to examine the relationship between invertebrate drift and flow. And that's an example of an ecological flow relationship,
yes.
which until recently we hadn't had it at our disposal to apply at these effects assessments.
Have you got a copy of the
Are you moving off to a different topic?
Yes.
Oh, I was going to say, don't you want to round that off, that line of questioning, to then ask, therefore, you know, the simple thresholds applied, the NES doesn't anticipate the simple threshold table is the only solution applied to a highly complex or to a catchment with a high degree of hydrological alteration, but that there are a greater range of methods to be considered. So you want to close it out?
Should I just let the answer? I think witness answer your question.
So we just close it out.
I'm sure I can't put that any better. So would you like to respond to that?
So you'd better summarise it again for me.
Okay, sorry.
I got lost.
So in your proposed method, yeah. You've got in your evidence you have a table which is recorded at page 7 of your evidence in chief. In summary, the default minimum flow and hydrological limits, and you've given us an explanation as to why that you recommend them. But the question is, table A4.3 from the draft NES strongly suggests that when you are in a catchment which has a high degree of hydrological alteration, that there are more methods that are brought to bear than a simple table describing MALF. Would that be fair?
That's correct, yeah. Those rules and the guidance in the NES do two things.
Mm-hmm.
One is that they... first of all, the limits in the NES provide a solution, an interim solution for streams where you don't have enough information to assess the effects of flow alteration. That's number one. Number two, there's guidance in the NES to ramp up the scale of effort in understanding the effects of flow alteration. The greater the degree of hydrological alteration and the greater the importance of in-stream values.
Mm.
And the limits also, those default, or if you can call them default limits, in the NES, and the table that I provided, provide another thing, and that is that they give you some forewarning of what the likelihood is of effect size as the hydrological alteration increases.
Mm.
So essentially the limits are saying if you proceed beyond these, there's an increasing chance of more than minor effects or adverse effects.
Mm-hmm.
They give you some reference point then to say, hey, we should be worried. We should now, if you want to allocate water, you need to get out and apply more complex methods.
Mm.
And the likelihood is that the higher the degree of hydrological alteration is, the more likely you are to find more than minor effects.
So the limits that you propose would apply to hydrologically complex and altered water bodies like Manuhetakea, Arrow, and the other one, Cardrona. They would still apply, but I think you're saying as a marker for risk and where greater effort then is required on a consent-by-consent basis to examine what are the risks and to have a better understanding of the hydrological flows and also the in-stream habitat, but then to examine the risks more closely. And it's at that point that the method in Table A4 comes into play.
Yeah, those increasingly complex methods would start being pulled out of your kit.
Yeah. Mm. So, okay, now I understand that. Thank you. That's helpful. Mm-hmm.
Just before I move on, I just want to just pick up on the proposed interim limits in the draft NES. So, can I ask you please just to turn to, firstly, page 26 of that document. Thank you.
I'll just pause there a second. 26?
Yes. Which is just shows us it. Section 5.1.3, the proposed interim limits for rivers and streams. And it points to there being a minimum flow and an allocation limit. And then if we go over the page to page 27, we have two sets of limits which mimic in some ways, or you have mimicked in your table, for rivers and streams with flows less than or equal to 5 cumex. It's the proposed minimum flow of 90% of mouth, as calculated by the council, and an allocation limit of whichever is the greater, 30% of mouth, or the total allocation from the catchment on the date that the NES came into force. And then a similar suite of provisions for rivers and streams greater than 5 cumex. And those are slightly different, aren't they, from the numbers presented in your table?
Yes, they are.
Right, I'd like to...
Relevance. So we've established that the numbers are different from the table versus the NES.
Yes.
What's the relevance of that? Where are you going to go with that?
Well, I'm just pointing out that the reproduction in Dr. Hayes' evidence was not a complete reflection of what was included in the draft NES provisions.
Accepting that as so, what's the significance of that?
Well, I think that it demonstrates that his standards are quite a lot more stringent.
Oh, right. That's where you need to go next. So I'll go. Oh, they're different. So what? So, and the importance to you is that they're more stringent. You need to now follow that so that actually that's, you know, you can put that to the witness, see what he has to say about that, and then make some... and ask them why that should be so, if there's a reason or not, and then make a submission about it. But the fact that they are different and you don't close it out, and again in cross-examination, it's problematic for the court, coming back to the point that you are making. You know, there may be a very good reason why they're different. There may not. And so you need to, again, close out that line of questioning. Don't just leave it hanging there to be closed out on a submission, because it may not... it's unsatisfactory for you to make what... Yeah, it's unsatisfactory. So now we know they're different.
Yeah, can... So, Dr. Hayes, can you explain why you have promoted a different threshold than supported in the NES?
Yeah, so those limits that I proposed in that table are a blend of the NES draft standards and also advice or the, from the presumptive standard of Richter's, Richter et al. 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's been increasing knowledge since the draft standards were written. And the presumptive standard of Richter's 2012, that takes account of some knowledge from international sources, which are more conservative.
Mm.
That's where that 20% level, 20% allocation came from.
The presumptive standard that you refer to in the Richter article is equally qualified, isn't it? In that I believe they say that the presumptive standard shouldn't be applied where detailed scientific assessments...
Yeah, it needs to be what the witness actually said.
this article. I think that's fair.
I've got the article.
You got the article?
I do.
Okay, good. Have you got copies of it?
Can I get... Morgan's got my copy, so can he give it to me, please?
I said that everyone's got a copy but us. So the witness, for the record, witness has been shown an article dealing with the Richter standard.
Thank you.
I take it that you're familiar with this article.
I am.
Oh, good. Well, that's good. I'm not, but which page do you want to...
Well, I'm looking at the first page.
Yep.
In particular, the abstract. And the final sentence of that says, our presumptive standard is intended for application only where detailed scientific assessments of environmental flow needs cannot be undertaken in the near term, doesn't it?
Yes, it does say that.
And so in many ways that takes us full circle, that we should be going back, I suppose, to table A43 and undertaking a full analysis, where particularly where we have increasing complexity.
Yes, that's correct.
And is that subject to having passed, if you like, your thresholds, your screening thresholds, which I guess that's how I, and that might be wrong for me to relate to them, but your thresholds at page 7, if you're caught by one of those thresholds indicating an increased risk of adverse effect, then you move to that table. Is that what your evidence
is? Yes, and in the same, you could use the draft environmental flow standard to do that as well. The degree of hydrological alteration guides you into what sort of effort you put into to assess the effects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the next question is, whatever's been done, whatever information you've got, what's the adequacy of those data and models to be able to then assess effects with some reasonable confidence?
So I'm going to put a proposition to Marihere Kea, the main water stem there, would that not pass the limits which are set out in your table?
The degree of hydrological alteration would exceed, we go into the, I think, moderate to high level of hydrological alteration, which would point you in the direction of wanting to apply hydraulic habitat modelling methods, perhaps assess effects on some ecological flow relationships. That is being done.
Another way of asking the question is, if Marihere Kea or Cadrona or Arrow did not or exceeded the limits which are set out in your table, then you would expect, if they were to be brought down on this plan change, you would simply expect an applicant for resource consent to start to apply the methods that are set out in the NES at table 8.4.
Yes, that's correct.
So that's a consenting issue. Yep,
yes.
Understood how you meant to understand your evidence. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd like to move on, if we may, and to talk about particularly your evidence in relation to low flows in galaxid habitat. So if we could go, please, to Table 1 at page 30 in your... So I understood that you believe that the long-term goal for Galaxid management should be the restoration of flows. Is that correct?
Yes, and ideally you would first want to know what sort of flows those species require.
Mm. In your mind, what is long-term?
Decades, I guess, and the reason I say that is because I'm aware of how long it takes to get the information that you need to manage these things well, fish populations.
Would you agree that in the catchments where we have these threatened non-migratory Galaxids in Otago, that their habitat is critical habitat?
Oh yes, because they're in refuges and they don't have very many other places to go. Yeah.
And would you agree that we should be protecting that critical habitat?
Yes.
And you would agree, and I think you have agreed with questions from one of my friends earlier, that trout are a significant risk to Galaxids if they were to get into that refuge habitat.
To the Otago non-migratory Galaxids,
yes. And so you would agree that we should be doing what we can to ensure that trout remain excluded from that critical habitat?
Yes, I agree.
Now, you have recommended in your evidence the thresholds for minimum flows and allocation limits. Have you undertaken any assessment of whether those levels would or could enable trout to gain access to the critical Galaxid habitat in Otago?
I have not.
Have you undertaken any investigation into how much habitat trout would need to be removed from as a result of the imposition of those flows?
No.
Sorry, can you just tell me, what was that question again? Have you undertaken an assessment
of the habitat that trout would need to be removed from?
Yes.
If the limits and minimum flows and allocation limits suggested by Dr. Hayes were applied.
Is that on the assumption and those flows provide access to predate on the non-migratory Galaxids?
Yes.
So that's really the full question. And with that in mind,
I haven't done such an assessment.
Yeah.
And so I presume you also haven't undertaken an investigation into the feasibility of that removal?
No, I haven't.
Have you considered what monitoring would be required to determine if and when trout were encroaching on that critical habitat?
No, but it would be considerable.
Any consideration as to who would undertake that monitoring?
I assume the responsibility would fall to DOC and maybe regional council.
And are you aware of whether they are intending on doing that work?
Oh, I'm not aware.
So I put it to you that the minimum flows and allocation limits that you promote also present the risk of more than minor adverse effects on critical habitat of galaxids?
Yes, if it was not put into monitoring the change in the distribution of trout, and if it was not put into installing and maintaining barriers to prevent their incursion into the critical areas that those galaxids are living in.
And does that issue point to the need, again, for us to undertake more detailed analysis of the appropriate minimum flows and allocation limits in various catchments?
Yeah, it points to more effort needing to be spent on the ecology, understanding the fish themselves, where they are, how they move around, and how flow influences that.
I think I've got no further questions, Your Honour.
Yep. Mr. Walsh.
Bear with me, Your Honour. I've been crossing out as we've been going, but I'll try not to canvass old ground. Dr. Hayes, you confirmed to my friend Mr. Moore that your table, table 3, essentially acts as a proxy for determining whether effects are minor or greater or more than minor, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Yes.
And do you understand that your client is seeking to apply the application of that table through Plan Change 7 changes to all non-complying activities?
I'm not entirely sure on that. I knew that there was some interest in applying the table in the plan.
Yes. Well, the relief sought or recommended by Mr. Farrell is to insert your table with some amendments, as Mr. Moore pointed out, into a policy for non-complying activities. And as far as I can read, it would apply to all non-complying activities. Does that accord with your advice from Mr. Farrell, or you're unaware of that?
I'm a bit fuzzy on that, so I'm not entirely clear.
And essentially that if an applicant didn't meet those thresholds, then the way that policy would work, as you understand it, would be that they would be unable to establish that they could pass through the first gateway of a non-complying activity. Do you understand that?
Okay, yeah, I understand that.
Yes, and I think you were in court yesterday?
Yes, that's right.
Yes, yeah. And so you may have heard Ms. King, the processing officer for Otago Regional Council, who confirmed to the court that she didn't consider an application could pass the second gateway of the 104D test in terms of not being contrary to the objectives and policies of Plan Change 7. Did you hear her say that?
I wasn't entirely paying attention. I was doing some other work at the back of the court, sorry, and I'm not a policy planner.
No. But essentially, if my recollection of Ms. King's advice or evidence is correct, then an applicant would be faced with a stark choice: either accept a six-year term or accept your thresholds as a non-complying activity. Would you accept that?
Yeah, I think that's my understanding.
Yes. Yeah. And because of the relief that your client has sought, in that your table would apply to all non-complying activities or applications, that takes into account, or doesn't take into account, I should say, individual characteristics of a particular stream or river, would it? If it applies to all of them?
No, that's correct. There's variation in streams out there, yeah.
And I think, as you confirmed to my friend Ms. Irving, it could in itself generate significant adverse effects, or more than minor adverse effects, I think she put to you, providing for this flow.
In the context of non-migratory galaxies, yes.
Yes, thank you. Yes, in that context.
Yeah.
And again, there's simply no room for a case-by-case assessment in the context of the non-migratory galaxids with the relief that your client has sought for a non-complying activity, is there?
Yeah, I think that's right. This witness has said he's not a policy planner, which would be fair enough.
Definitely.
It's not fair putting to him where Mr. Farrell has got to in his documentation the application of the threshold test under section 104D. I understand exactly where you're going, but you know, the really interesting question, so this is actually, I'm not ignoring the cross-examination from Mr. Moore and the other values, you know, because actually that was really important.
Yep.
But is this table to be understood, if you like, as a screen? It's actually pointing to risk about which, if you are being tripped up on those allocations or on those limits, there is now a risk which then you need to be assessing in your resource consent application. And, in accordance with, I think he said, any standard, you know, the table A point, whatever it is. What is it, Miss Brooke?
A4.3,
if that's the right table. You know, so it's just a screening method which kicks you out and says you need to do something more because you've actually at now a threshold of effect. That's, as I understand, might be the purpose of this thing. Would that be right?
Yes.
Broadly speaking, if you hit one of the limits, that's now pointing to a risk that there will be more than minor adverse effects. Correct?
Yeah, and it clearly shows that if you're not reaching those limits, if you're under those,
yep,
then there's the opportunity to allocate water.
That's right. But above that, then you need to be undertaking quite a comprehensive review of information.
That's correct.
Yeah, in accordance with, amongst other things, I guess, Table A4.3 of the draft NES, discussion document. So that's how I understand how it works. Whether it should have been put into a policy or rule that way, I think,
well, that's
questionable.
I'll follow that
and
up with Mr. Farrell.
For all of the reasons that you're intimating.
Yes, but my read of the policy is it acts beyond a screening threshold. It directs the decision maker that thou has before them an effect or an application that will generate more than minor effects if you don't meet that, which is kind of beyond screening. It's a more of a binary decision.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. So then the real, you know, the questions are, and I think this is, you know, which is what I was putting to him observing, is what is the purpose of this threshold? How does this witness see the threshold? As a screening device, or about which something, if you hit it, something much more needs to be done, and which I think the evidence will be Motorhead of Care does it on its resource consent application, or is it something else?
Yes, and I think the witness has said he's a fuzzy on the application of this, so I'm not going to pursue that any further.
But I think it's valid to pursue what is the point in recommending it. And then valid to pursue of Mr. Farrell, did he understand that correctly, and is that how it's actually been picked up in his draft?
Yes.
Because I think there's enough now on the record to show that there is a tension there.
Yes, very much. Well, maybe I'll pick that up at the conclusion. Mm-hmm. I'll see what notes I've got left and then come back, Mum. Now, is it your understanding that your table would only apply in respect of applications subject to Plan Change 7?
You mean,
if it were accepted by the court, it would only apply to non-complying applications that are subject to the Plan Change 7 provisions?
If you're asking, do I see limits like that being applied beyond 6 years, like into the future, then there is some value in that.
That wasn't my question.
Yeah.
because we're not dealing with the new regional plan.
Okay.
We're dealing with Plan Change 7. Do you understand
that?
Right. And that your recommendation for Table 3 has been picked up by Mr. Farrell for insertion into a policy provision in Plan Change 7.
Okay.
So you would accept that the table will only have application to non-complying activities under Plan Change 7.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then. Yes, that's my understanding.
Yes. So you could have the situation where an upstream permit holder who is subject to Plan Change 7 wishes to comply with your threshold table and ensure, and in so doing, ensure that the minimum and residual flows are met. Right?
Yes. Yeah.
But there could be a new downstream taker of water from the same stream who's not subject or not a deemed permit holder and is not subject to Plan Change 7 in the context of their take application, who could then take that water from the stream without any reference to your table.
Yes, I guess.
Now, for some of these deemed permits, they are quite historic, and some would date back to the 1860s. Is that your understanding?
Mm, yes.
Yes. And I think one of my clients, the Beaumont, dates back to 1868. And it doesn't have, or it hasn't operated with your thresholds for minimum and residual flow. And so would you accept that applying those would represent, and I suppose this is the very purpose of your table, a material hydrological change downstream of the abstraction point?
It could well do, yes.
Lost the thread. Are you saying applying those to persons who are not applicants for either a new take or a replacement take, including a deemed permit, or, you know...
No, my previous...
Is this like a review condition of something now?
No, my previous question just related to the fact that the table or those limits would only apply to non-complying deemed permit holders, and that someone downstream could take water from the same water body without having to meet those thresholds at all, because they're outside of Plan Change 7.
If you're existing take and you're not applying for a renewal, absolutely.
Yep. And so, sorry, I didn't foreshadow my next... The next question, I'd moved on. It was just the standalone question, the previous one. So I'm now just asking, if you apply those limits, that would represent a material change to the hydrology downstream of the abstraction by meeting it.
If you apply them to an applicant to renew the water, for a new water take or renewal of a permit, regardless of what that is, if you apply that, depends on how you apply, whether it's as a screening method, which is what this witness's evidence is, or as some, or to apply in terms of somehow requiring that to be the flow in the river.
Well, I think an applicant would have no choice but to comply with them, with those thresholds, because to get through the gateway, you would have to do that to be a non-complying activity. You'd have to. Oh, I think the evidence has been, Mr. De Placemaker couldn't think of an example, and Ms. King was more definitive, saying there is no examples of getting through the second gateway. And this policy, if it was applied, would...
I think that's a policy question, again, because my sense of it is this witness's evidence about this table is he's proposed this table as a threshold beyond which there is a... at risk of an adverse effect to the in-stream ecology, and you're nodding, and that's correct.
Yes, it is.
That then warrants an applicant for resource consent to go through quite a rigorous method under the draft NES or some other method to demonstrate, notwithstanding the risk, we've managed the risk. How do we manage the risk? I don't know, but that would be for the applicant to demonstrate.
Yes. I wasn't putting...
It's not been picked up that way necessarily by Mr. Farrell, but we can understand why Mr. Farrell has not picked it up that way when we come to him.
Yeah, sorry for the confusion. Mm. I wasn't actually putting what you and I were discussing as a question to this witness.
So the question for the witnesses is everybody complies with those minimum flows and the allocation limits. That would be a dramatic change to the environment.
Yeah, that's where I was heading. And then,
okay.
And then that would represent an opportunity for trout to move, migrate upstream, and habitat of the Glaxes, and I think Mr. Moore had covered that.
And Ms. Irving has also covered that.
And then Ms. Irving covered that, so I was going to skip over that.
Right.
And then I was going to get to barriers.
Barriers, okay.
Yes.
Right, barriers.
At paragraph 160, Dr. Hayes, you advocate for limiting the invasion and re-invasion by trout by physical or electric barriers, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yes. And is the use of your words limiting and reinvasion some sort of acknowledgement that trout may make their way upstream into the habitat of the Glaxes?
Yes.
Yes. Now, are you aware, or has Mr. Farrell explained to you, that there is no rule proposed by your client requiring a barrier to be provided under Plan Change 7?
I answered a question before. I was uncertain about that. So, yeah.
Right. And did you or Mr. Farrell or anyone at Fish and Game investigate the consent requirements for installing in-stream barriers in the beds of rivers or streams?
I've been involved in no such discussion.
Okay. I'll save that for Mr. Farrell. So Mr. Farrell hasn't explained to you, at least, that one would need a discretionary resource consent to install such a barrier as you propose?
No, he hasn't explained. Yeah. I've been in no discussion like that with Mr. Farrell.
Okay.
Or anybody.
And in terms of the importance that you place upon barriers, are you acting on the assumption that a barrier would be practicable and effective in all instances, in all streams?
I recognise that the introduction, installation and maintenance of barriers to prevent fish getting past that point is a formidable task.
Is it what? Sorry,
is a formidable task.
Formidable.
Maybe that's overstating. It's a challenging task. So it's not to be underestimated.
Yes. And it's a formidable cost.
It would be expensive.
Yes.
Yes.
And it would generate its own set of adverse effects potentially too, wouldn't it? There would be effects on natural character.
Yes, locally.
Yes, and there would be effects on, for example, the upstream non-migratory population of Glaxes, insofar as no further biological diversity could move upstream to support those Glaxes.
Oh, it's true. Yeah, except that if you've got what we call them source populations, so if you've protected a population of non-migratory Glaxes upstream, then they will spill over to get over the barrier or around the barrier. They will go downstream as well. Some will get out.
Yes, but none would go up, would they? That would
not
be an effective barrier.
No, that's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
And who would have the costs of maintaining these barriers? Who would that fall upon?
I don't know.
No. And no doubt you would agree that maintenance is very important, because if there were a hole in the barrier as a result of flood flows or something, that would present an opportunity for trout to invade the upstream habitat, wouldn't
it? Yes, that's correct.
Yes. And have you turned your mind to some of the practical difficulties where these barriers might be in remote locations where inspections during the middle of winter may not be practicable?
I agree entirely. That's why I said it's a challenging task.
Yes, and you would also no doubt agree that there'd be some locations that a barrier is simply not practicable.
Especially where you had very highly variable flows, and a stream that in which the banks were moving around, so it was hard to anchor a barrier.
Yes.
If you had very hard banks, like bedrock, you've got more chance of doing that.
And I think you answered to a question from Ms. Irvine that you see the obligation to remove trout from a catchment or a stream falling upon the department or the regional council. Is that my recollection?
That's my first stab at that question. I haven't given sufficient thought to that and the statutory requirements of the various agencies.
Yes.
as to who would be compelled to be involved.
And you haven't given any examples in your evidence where such trout removal in a catchment has been successful in the short or the long term, have you?
No, I haven't done that.
No, thank you. Nothing further, Mum.
Thank you. All right. Re-examination.
No, thank you, Mum.
Nothing? Okay, thank you. And no questions from me either. So thank you very much for your evidence. Found it very interesting. So thank you.
Okay.
So that's us.
Yep. Yes, that's us. That's all we can. I think even if we could fit in another witness, I don't think my friends are prepared, which is fair enough.
Yep. So okay, good. So that's us until 9:30 next Tuesday. As I've indicated, we need to release another minute about giving people more time for cross-examination in terms of any supplementary evidence yet to come, including certain witnesses or parties that we've named. Thing that we're still troubled by, is this creature called priorities. What sort of creature could this be? Is this, in terms of its, how is one to regard it, as whether, a condition, a valid resource consent condition or a deemed condition, which might put it into a different category of being altogether. And then, of course, anyway, we've talked about that yesterday. One of the things that we do need to pin down, though, is who, apart from ORAG and the director, has an interest in bringing forward the priorities? And we thought Mr. Palsmaker should know that.
Mr. Palsmaker has been looking at that.
Oh,
I'm not sure what the outcome of his analysis is, but
What's a reasonable time frame in terms of asking that to come back with a response to that? Because I think we would then want to say, look, people who are interested in this topic, we're going to be asking for legal submissions. Some of them will know that some people will have lawyers, but not all of them will. But, so what's a reasonable
time? I can just go and quickly ask if that would... by Tuesday morning sounds.
It's going to be relatively easy to do in so far as. You have a schedule which already picks up on where the submissions are going, but does the schedule, the points of submission and further submission, does that, though, spit out, if you like, the priority?
I suspect that's the unknown. I was thinking how we might go about that task. We'll do a word search for priority amongst the submissions and just see where priority or priorities appears. And that is a task that could be done reasonably swiftly, would have thought, but then there may be some further nuance in relation to how parties have preferred to prioritise.
Don't use that word, but use something else.
In terms of existing flow regime, for example.
Okay. Well, no, that's fine. If you need more time, you're to indicate that. I've indicated that I do wish to hear further from the Director General, and I've also indicated to Mr. Page, that we do need to get a proper understanding of the status of those priorities now, and what is proposed going into the future. I haven't articulated the legal issues, though, and that's something that some thought has to be given to that. Is that something that you can confer on with at least council who are represented, who have an interest in priorities?
Yes, I think that's something that we could do, and it's certainly exercising my mind in terms of the what I think is the legal question underpinning this, in terms of are the current priorities to be seen as valid conditions of a resource consent.
That's where I think it starts, the paper trail.
Yep. I'll confer with my friends and see whether we can drill down and identify what their legal issues are, and then there's at least a framework within which each of us will address those issues.
That would be really helpful, rather than everybody addressing something slightly different on the same topic. Ms. Page.
Can I tease that out just a little bit further, just so I understand your thinking, is so that my friend and I can have sensible conversations. Not that we don't, but if the starting point of the issue seems to be section 413(2), and so it seems to me that by statute they are conditions of deemed permits, as I understood the exchange with you the other day, it seemed to me that the question was focused on can they nevertheless be transferred to RMA permits, notwithstanding that they are lawfully part of deemed permits?
I think that's the second part of the question. The first part of the question is starting in that section, so I'm just trying to dial it up. 413.
Subsection 2.
Yeah. Just bear with me, I'll just get that in front of me.
The part of that subsection that deals with priorities is the reference to Section 11 of the Water and Soil Conservation Act, which is the part of that Act that carries over the priorities into the Water and Soil Conservation Regime from the old Mining Privilege Regime.
So the starting point, I think you're right, but I mean that's for you to work out with your friends, but it seems to be 413 subsection 2. So every deemed permit resulting from a mining privilege shall be deemed to include, so two deems, as conditions of a permit, the provisions of the Water and Soil Conservation Act. So that's your starting point. The fact that you've got a deemed permit, which is also then further deeming as conditions of a permit those provisions, does that, is your starting point, that it is a valid resource management condition made for the purposes of the statute or made for an entirely different purpose or a different statute? Are they from there? I would have thought the question seems to be in accordance with general usage. Are these civil rights or interests? The priorities that give rise to civil rights or interests. Notwithstanding that they are concluded on a deemed permit as a deemed condition. And that is how you're to regard them. Or are they to be properly regarded as a condition on a resource consent, or better, deemed permit, which is there for a valid resource management reason? I don't know. But when you get to 1 October, what then happens? Do they expire in total? Or are they able to be picked up somehow by a rule in the plan? And I say rule in the plan because of section 108AA. Either because there's a rule in the plan or because they're dealing with something to do with adverse effects on the environment. So how are they, can they be lawfully picked up? In other words, by a mechanism which is addressing something which is validly being addressed in the Resource Management Act.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and if they are what is being picked up, is it what I think your client will say, well, that's regulating rights as between extractors, so the impact of abstraction on one another? Or is it because it's also regulating an effect in the environment as a consequence of that abstraction? I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think it seems to me the difficulty lies in the absence of a further deeming from the deemed permits into the new permits. Is there lawful authority to carry them over?
I don't know. You see, I don't know that it's whether it's lawful
question.
Authority to carry it over,
yeah.
Or whether you could say whether there could simply be a rule. And, you know, so ignore the history, assume the history was never there anyway. But this is how, you know, abstractors have been taking water. There is this history, therefore there needs to be a rule and a plan. So, you know, even you could start again and say, actually, we need to be looking at this
yes.
as a mechanism.
And then the test arises to whether there's a resource management purpose that that underlies that.
Yeah, well, that's right. And then, and as between abstractors, there may be. As for an effect on the environment, there may be.
Yes.
And both, the combination of both, there may be. But then it's not, I would not have thought it's satisfactory for a rule in the plan that says, oh, yes, just bring forward priorities. What on earth does that mean? And how would that be implemented by a regional council when an application comes in? So this is really testing. The fact that you say the words does not make it so has to be capable of being implemented somehow. And I think I'm struggling from the evidence that I've seen to understand how that would be so. But
yes.
So not just in terms of the legal framework, but an example or two to illustrate the point might be helpful.
And the fact
and it may not be the ones that have already been supplied to us. There may be better examples.
Oh, yeah, in terms of deemed permits. Though that was really helpful because I'd never seen one of those things. But the fact that everybody in the Manahita Kia can or will is important, but what about the other catchments, the other 139? How is this thing going to be implemented? And I suppose the point that Mr. Welch was making was, might actually be exactly the point, but what if they're existing? No, that won't happen. That's okay. No, I don't need to. You're either on or off as of the 1st of October. What if there are other? I understand the evidence, and again, I've signalled that, you know, maybe you've got a better a witness to come, but and I don't think it's Ms. Dicey necessarily.
Well,
are there resource consents, which are former deemed permits, which have been rolled over into a water permit, you know, in relation to which have been replaced by a water permit, which no longer have these things attaching to them? The answer from the Regional Council was yes, as far as Witness King was concerned yesterday, in every instance when they've been replaced, they don't have those conditions attached. So
well,
what on earth are we doing in this space if it's not important to farmers now?
Well, I can explain the answer to that.
I need evidence on that. You know, so this is complex.
Yes.
This is potentially complex. Potentially the answer of the court would be no party has put up a case for how this is to be included, so
well,
I'm going to ignore it.
I mean, the court actually has a recently live example of exactly the situation with the Lindis permits renewals decision, which are not subject to challenge, happily, because priorities and how they worked in the catchment was a live issue there, because the big race, was it Commissioner Edmonds will remember, had the highest priority, was at the lowest part of the catchment. And so what was proposed by the applicant in that case was a water sharing regime that required each permit holder to be part of, and a methodology to be established to ensure that the minimum flows could be met by all parties. And the reason for that is because the applicants anticipated that the priority regime would disappear on the 1st of October 2021, and there simply had to be an alternative regime to manage access to the water as between permit holders to replace that. And that's the consistent approach that the Regional Council has taken, is that you need to replace one method with another.
Well, if you are right, Ms King wasn't aware of it. And I put that question to her, and she just seemed, she actually answered in the negative. No one's looking for the priorities, and the consents aren't being granted with priorities.
No, Ms King was absolutely right, with respect, but what she wasn't asked and didn't explain was, given that nobody is seeking to re-establish the priority regime or carry them over, what has the Regional Council been doing to address that using alternative methods?
Now, if you knew that that was an important follow-on question from the court's question, you should have asked it, again, to round out what the evidence is, so that the court's not left with one party saying, oh, this is the regime, with that actually the Regional Council asking.
Well, with respect, I misunderstood the breadth of where your questions were going. I had thought that you were looking for a confined point, which is that are the priorities being carried over? And the witness answered correctly, and I didn't see any need to intervene.
Well, actually, that would be incorrect, because they are being carried over, but in a different way is what your submission is, and through a different mechanism, correct?
Well, I submit not quite.
Not quite.
Because priorities are, by their nature, first come, first served. Water sharing agreements are the antithesis of that. And so the purpose is in some ways similar, but the method is entirely the inverse of the priority scheme. And so I still think Ms King's answer to the question was fair.
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
She doesn't.
So, usual honesty from Surrey?
Anyway. That's actually spooky, isn't it? But
it is. And so, I mean, this is something that particularly Ms McKeague, Ms Dicey and Mr Hickey are dealing with every day.
But I think, and I have thought, I've been at pains to say this all the way along, you need to be putting your case to the Regional Council and any other relevant witness so that they can understand what your framework is and what your thinking is. And it may, and I think ultimately you'll say, well, that goes to a consenting sort of outcome. But it hasn't been tested with these witnesses. And so that, you know, that's what's disturbed me about not knowing where your theory of a case is, and putting the theory to the witnesses in a way which is complete so that they can respond to that, because they might very well have said, yeah, you're right, and so something else is required.
Well, in a funny way, the question of priorities is very much a sidewind for ORUG. Because ORUG's central case is that we should be moving out of the deemed permit regime and into a replacement with substantive RMA consents. That's our point number one. The relevance of the priorities is only that if we are not to do it and the court is minded to preserve the status quo, what is the status quo and how would you do that absent the priority regime carrying over? And that's how it becomes important.
And Mr De Plaismaker and Balesmaker, and you know, you might challenge, I don't know, you think you have challenged this, he's given a response to that, and the court needs to think about that in terms of the priorities, if you like, being reflected or echoed back in terms of the flow meter data.
Yes. But your first point for council to assist you with is, can you?
Well, first point is, what are these things? Under section 4.132, are they presently a valid resource management condition or a condition imposed for a different purpose altogether? And that's the starting point, but regardless of that, can they be something replacing them, be brought forward as a mechanism probably a rule in this plan or not. And of course your case is not, because you know you've got the trace and the flow meter data.
Anyway, I thought it was useful to raise it.
And Mum, because I don't address you or scheduled to address you for another 2 months, and so I have some time to give it some more thought, for the Trustpower mining privileges, they're rather different as well, because they are by statute not subject to any loss of priority, rather than through the conditions that may appear on the individual permits, and that's through the Dunedin City Corporation Empowering Act.
But you see, still, that's front of mind, not.
No. No, it's still on the statute books. Yeah. So
you can't lose your priority. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes. Well, interestingly, the section goes on and says that the consent, the privileges are granted in perpetuity as well.
Ooh.
So I've got some thinking to do, but I just thought I should raise rather than say
right
in 2 months
to...
and you say, well, Mr. Walsh, why didn't you say something about that at the time? So.
No, you're right to flag it. The situation's different again for your client. Yep. Mm-hmm. Is it just your client or any other hydro generator?
No, it's a specific act that was for the basically the collection of the various mining privileges for the establishment of the Waipori scheme.
Yeah.
And it protected those for hydroelectric purposes.
Okay. Anyway, getting back to that direction, I do think you need to confer with at least those parties that are legally represented with an interest in those priorities. You know, you'll come back to me separately, I suspect, in relation to Trustpower, because it's, you know, it's got its own mechanism under a different act, evidently. But you know, those matters, those primary sector deemed permits and parties with an interest in that, if they've had council appointed to confer over the legal issues that arise and how that might be framed as issues for the court to determine, when would you like to do that by pot? You can't really answer the question until you know who's actually got an interest in this thing.
Yes, and I'm conscious that my friend has to open his case on Tuesday, I think you're on the schedule for
Tuesday.
And it may not be before Tuesday.
That's okay, we might direct further submissions from Mr. Page.
Yeah, and that's perhaps a sensible way forward.
Okay.
I would have thought by, say, Friday next week, that there's a reporting date for some other things, the 26th, that would be a date we could work towards.
Okay, 26th, fair enough. Yes, okay. Very good. All right, well, we'll leave it at that, I think. Ms. Baker Galloway, nothing you'd like to raise? No? All good. Okay, so we'll leave it at that. And again, back here at 9:30 on Tuesday with your case initially. Yep. And then we're diverting to other planners. Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
All rise.